Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll talk tech. In both Kern and Fresno counties, young software and technology entrepreneurs are driving a growing part of the Valley's workforce. Could tech be the next big driver of the regional economy? We'll talk to local tech leaders from both Bakersfield and Fresno about what the region needs to do to capitalize on current assets and about their ambitious plans to grow for the future. We'll also learn why efforts to save the salmon in the Delta have a new foe, and we'll talk to the author of a new book about the rich history of the Tulare County community of Lindsay. Right now, though, we turn our attention to the forests of the Sierra Nevada. It's estimated that tens of millions of trees have died as a result of the drought and bark beetles. As a result, we've been told the risk of wildfire is higher than normal. But as FM89's Carrie Klein reports, that might not be the case.
Look out over a hillside at 5,000 feet in the Sierra Nevada, and that landscape, usually a wash of green pines, firs, and cedars, is probably smudged with reds and browns. Ranger Al Watson with Sequoia National Forest explains.
So you're looking at sometimes in areas of 50% or more mortality, where 3 years ago there was only a few sporadic types of dead trees here and there.
The Forest Service puts the latest death toll at 66 million trees in just California. And for a state that's hot, dry, and in the fifth year of drought, Watson says those trees are a danger.
More dead trees and higher concentration mean a lot more fire risk.
It's easy to draw a straight line between dead trees and wildfires. After all, Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack has used the words extreme and catastrophic to articulate the hazard. And wildfire risk was a major reason Governor Brown declared a state of emergency last fall. But among researchers, there's some dispute as to how this tree mortality actually influences fire behavior. Many scientific studies have demonstrated no relationship between stands of dead trees and fire severity. Some studies even found wildfires are weaker in areas hard hit by tree die-offs. So how can these opposing arguments coexist? It's because the conditions around the dead trees vary so wildly, says forester Brian Block. He and Ranger Watson took me out to the forest near Lake Isabella to survey the damage. He points out a thick ponderosa pine with reddish-brown needles.
So this tree here was attacked by beetles. It probably took a couple years for it to succumb.
This one still got its bark and needles, which are important for fire risk.
So these trees that you see on the landscape that are red and brown, they have a lot of fine needles on them, and they will ignite very easily. Once they start losing all of their fine needles and they basically become tree trunks with a few branches on them that are 3 inches in diameter, they don't burn very well.
Turns out, standing trees, even when dead, don't actually ignite very easily.
Like you're building a fire in your fireplace, you lay the logs all down. You wouldn't want to stand them all up, because if you put a match to it, you can't get them to light. But if you lay your sticks crossways, there's more surface area, they burn better. Same thing with a standing tree.
But forests are made up of any combination of trees, standing or fallen, with or without needles. So it's on balance, Block says, that more dead trees are estimated to mean a greater fire risk. But Chad Hansen, an ecologist with the nonprofit conservation group the John Muir Project, says it's not true that dead trees increase the risk of wildfire. First off, research doesn't show that fallen trees are any more flammable than standing ones.
Well, you do have more woody material on the forest floor on one hand. On the other hand, these down logs, especially once they start decaying a little bit, they act like giant sponges. They retain and soak up enormous amounts of water on the forest floor.
Another argument you're likely to hear is that because of drought, fires are already burning hotter than usual, and that increased intensity will light up those tough-to-burn standing trees. Hansen says, yes, but...
if you've got hotter, drier, windier conditions, then you're generally going to have more intense fire behavior overall. And so if you've got the conditions that are right for a high-intensity fire patch, the winds really whip up more, and it's kind of the peak heat of the day, those trees are going to burn pretty intensely, whether they're alive or dead.
What he's saying is the closest indicator of how fast and hot a fire will burn is not whether the trees are dead or alive. It's the weather.
People really are very focused on forest structure and the density of the forest and, you know, live trees and dead trees. And really the fact is that what the science is telling us is that fires are overwhelmingly weather-driven. Hot, dry, windy conditions, that's going to give you more intense fire.
And really, here in California, we're always at risk for wildfires. Just ask Stan Lung.
Now this black area you're looking right in front of you, that's where we had our fire here a year ago.
Lung lives in Bass Lake, a town whose woody backdrop has been ravaged by drought and bark beetles. He remembers watching the Courtney Fire devour a hill just across the lake in 2014. It was so hot, it didn't matter if the trees were standing or fallen, alive or dead.
It just rolled down that mountain there like it was a lawnmower. It just came rolling down. And you could just see the trees just explode. And that's what they do. They explode and they throw fire out around them. It's scary.
The 86-year-old has watched PG&E take down scores of towering dead pine trees that had lived in Bass Lake longer than he has. Five of them were on his property. He was sad to see them go, but he knows if there's even the remotest possibility that they put his house in more fire danger than they did when they were alive, cutting them down was worth it. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The phrase seeing is believing takes on a whole new meaning in a world full of cell phone videos and police body cameras. Every officer in the Fresno Police Department now wears a camera that records the majority of their work. However, what's done with that footage, when it's released or isn't released to the public, is a murky subject, as Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports.
Let me see your hands.
That's a clip of police body camera video from just moments before the fatal shooting of 19-year-old Dylan Noble. As Valley Public Radio reported recently, that video footage, coupled with cell phone video taken by a bystander, is part of what has given the story of this shooting such remarkable public interest. It has also raised new questions about the rules governing the use of body cameras. Currently, there are no detailed policies for which videos the Fresno police release to the public and when. On the day he released the footage, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer says it should stay that way.
The policy that we have in place says that the video will be released at the conclusion of the criminal investigation. However, if there is a greater good for that video to be released before that time, then I, as a police chief, have the right to make that decision.
Currently, Fresno Police consider the videos to be evidence, which means they can be withheld from public records request. Starting this year, every officer in the force is wearing a body camera, like the one that captured the Dylan Noble shooting. But what is the purpose behind strapping a camera on every officer? Many consider the cameras to be a mechanism to help reduce police use of force, not just capture it.
For every 1% increase in officers that actually use the camera or are compliant with policy, you get a 1% reduction in complaints against the police.
Charles Katz is a researcher in Arizona who studied the impact of body cameras at the Phoenix Police Department. He says the cameras are still so new, there is little research about them. But what research does exist seems to show that the body cameras reduce police use of force because the officers and civilians behave differently when they know they're on camera. But they also provide an impartial record for police and the community to observe and interpret. Katz says this is important because of the high level of authority police are granted.
What makes them so unique is that they have the ability to use force. They are legally allowed to use deadly force. And for those reasons, they need additional training. They need high personnel standards so that you can reduce the likelihood of those mistakes being made.
But Katz also cautions against being a Monday morning quarterback when a person can view a video outside the heat of an intense encounter. Civil liberties groups have played up the positive community trust-building effects of having officers be on film at all times. But there is also the potential the cameras could do the opposite if it's not clear why videos are or are not released, says Catherine Wagner with the ACLU.
The existence of the video without its release has been a backward step for public trust because, you know, there's a chance that members of a community will feel that departments are only releasing videos that make them look good and withholding them when they don't.
Wagner says there are no state laws governing when footage can or should be released, leaving it to the departments. To be sure, not everything captured on an officer's camera is of public interest. Think child sex abuse victims, domestic violence victims, or a random DUI stop of a non-public person. Wagner says there are levels of privacy that people who are stopped, questioned, or even arrested by police deserve. But that is why Wagner says every department should develop a detailed policy governing the release of police body video so that the public can clearly understand why particular footage is or isn't being released.
When they capture a critical incident like a shooting or a serious use of force, you know, when there's an allegation of misconduct, certainly serious misconduct, and then when the subject of the video themselves requests the video, then they should have access to that.
And if the person in the video wants to release it, Wagner says they should be allowed to. Wagner points to San Francisco and Oakland police departments, who she says have detailed policies governing the release of footage, including additional steps like blurring faces or excluding personal details if there are privacy concerns about the video's release. The state legislature considered several bills regarding setting a statewide policy covering the release of police body camera footage, which are paid for with public money and worn by government employees. But the bills satisfied neither groups like the ACLU or police unions, and they died. There's been little movement in the interim. For the time being, unless Fresno police develop a concrete policy, release of any future videos will remain up to the discretion of Chief Jerry Dyer. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This is Valley Edition. The Valley is known for growing things, but lately some of the most notable crops that have been harvested here in Central California haven't been grown on a farm. They've been grown in front of a laptop or an iPad. Just last month, local email marketing company Drip was acquired by a major player in the industry. Another local startup got $500,000 in venture capital for their market research software. And in Bakersfield, new tech incubators are helping foster that community's software industry, helping them develop in co-working spaces. So what can the Valley do to capitalize on the momentum that's already there in the local software and technology industry? We have three local tech entrepreneurs joining us in our studio today. First of all, from Bakersfield, we have Alyssa Harley and Scott Burton. They represent two different groups. Alyssa's from Kit Community, Kern Innovation and Technology, and Scott Burton is from Mesh. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks
for having us.
And also another venture from Fresno that is inspiring ventures in Bakersfield and other places, and that's Bitwise. We have Bitwise co-founder Irma Olguin with us today. Irma, welcome as well. I want to start with you. Back 8 years ago, when you started talking about building this community in Central California, what was the response you got, both from people who were interested in it and people who were sort of on the periphery or maybe even outside, weren't already tech people? What did they tell you?
Yeah, for a city that's really concerned with brain drain, the answer to that was really terrible. It was a pointing toward the coast and saying the Bay Area is that way, which is really not an acceptable answer. And that's what we set out to change.
And Scott, what did you hear? You've been in this a little over a year now with Mesh, which is up on the second floor above Dagny's Coffee. That is something that I imagine you encountered as well?
Yeah, something similar. I mean, a lot of it was more, what's co-working? A lot of people don't understand exactly what it is or what we do. And so there's kind of an education part to it. So I think a lot of people now are understanding what co-working means and what we're trying to do.
And Alyssa, what have you heard along those lines from people? Is there a negative perception out there in the general public?
Well, I think the more dominant industries in Bakersfield are oil and agriculture. So many of the technologies that were developed were related to those industries. And so when Kit first started, oil was down and agriculture was hurt really bad by the drought. So what can you do in Bakersfield is really what I got. And you can't really do anything when oil's down.
A very good point, and that really is another interesting thing. And I know, Irma, you pointed that out in that you've made reference to the technology that's been developed over the past century by the ag industry and others here, the sort of the pioneers that helped make things happen in the valley. Scott, I want to touch upon something that you said, though, and you mentioned the people not understanding the value of co-working or even what it is. What is the value of bringing together different tech entrepreneurs or even freelancers together in one place? Because, Irma, you've done a great job with that. Scott, what have you heard? And I'll open up to you as well.
Well, I think a lot of it is the opportunities that come about because people are talking to each other and networking that normally wouldn't. And there's also more of a public awareness that happens because, you know, stuff like what Kit's doing with the hackathons coming up, it allows people to get together and create things in technology that normally wouldn't have happened. And we've seen a lot of that. We've seen a lot of people collaborating on projects together, projects happening outside that people didn't realize, hey, there's people in Bakersfield that can actually make software and make some really cool stuff. And I think that's the biggest thing.
And what would you say, Irma, on that? What is the value of having a co-working space? I mean, I guess you could say Bitwise is almost a real estate company as much as it is a software company, because you've brought together this great facility that you have hundreds of different entrepreneurs working there and businesses located there.
Yeah, these days it's hard to tell the difference, isn't it? In order to bring people together or to see the value in it, I think it's important to recognize that life is very much like a pinball machine, and the individual, the technologist, is a pinball. And so it's our job really to create spaces where that technologist, that entrepreneur, can crash into that next opportunity, and then they stay there and sort of bounce back and forth and take advantage of that for as long as they can. And so that's what co-working does, is it creates that sort of micro pinball machine.
Alyssa, I want to open this up to you, and that Irma mentioned when she first started out that people said, well, go to the Bay Area, and we hear that in Fresno. Do you hear a similar thing about Los Angeles in Bakersfield? You know, you're so close in that respect. Is it a blessing or a curse to be close to these major tech centers but also still far enough away to be distant?
Yeah, well, I think in Bakersfield, being somewhat in the center, we get the both. We get brain drain up to San Francisco and down towards LA, and we also get a lot of major reporting coming out from LA that only really views Bakersfield in the negative sense. So trying to even change that dynamic with our nearest large metropolitan center is different. And you also have something at Tech Coast Angels, which is Southern California's angel investment group. And they go up to the Central Coast, but they don't come into the Central Valley.
Irma, you've had some recent successes or seen these recent successes in this area as far as venture capital, angel investors and others, even some outright acquisitions. Is that an area that we still need to see more focus on here in terms of having both locals and out-of-towners who are willing to invest in some of these ideas and entrepreneurs?
I think there's a common notion that any city who wants to be, you know, the next Silicon Valley needs to really engage in different money. I'm not entirely bought into that idea. I think that bringing in investment is very splashy and can certainly accelerate growth for certain companies, but I don't think that that's what the bones are made out of when you are attempting to build a new ecosystem. I think what we've seen recently with these different companies being funded is really neat, but when you look at the economic impact of those things, at least in the short term, it's not really greater than what some of these larger companies have been doing for a long time. And we can get into the differences between sort of business-to-consumer and business-to-business investment and those types of things. But there are some really large companies here in Fresno that are not getting the level of attention because they don't have the investment, but are creating a larger economic impact. So,
Scott, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's exactly the same where we're at. I mean, there's some companies that are related to oil and doing technology with oil in Bakersfield that, you know, are already established, and they have employees, and then you have a company like Lightspeed as well. I think to have the ecosystem where we're at, we're missing a lot of the parts. I think Fresno's way ahead of us and has a lot of the pieces needed for that. So we're trying to get some of those you know, financing and different parts of the ecosystem there, so we can actually have a system where people can grow their companies. But I do think there are companies that are contributing now that aren't necessarily looked at as far as a tech company in Bakersfield.
You mentioned Lightspeed. How much of a loss is that to the community, or does it really matter in the big picture because there's all these other things going on? And this is a tech company that's been involved in education software for some time and a decent-sized employer. What's the mood in the tech community with the announcement that they're moving their operations to Austin?
Well, I think as far as employment, I think that's an issue because there's a lot of developers and people who work there that are either moving to Austin or they're losing their job and trying to work somewhere else. But as far as the big picture, I don't think it matters much because they've been there for 18 years and they thrived. So obviously we have something in Bakersfield that keeps a company there for 18 years and does well. And there's probably other reasons as well why they're leaving that aren't necessarily related to the location. But I don't think it really impacts us in the long term. I think if anything, it gives us more of a workforce for people to do projects in Bakersfield and more of a reason to make things happen in Bakersfield.
Speaking of people who are doing those projects, sounds like the sort of people who might be interested in a hackathon. Alyssa, you mentioned those sorts of things happening in Kern County. What are you putting together along those lines?
So in a couple of weeks, we have a wildfire hackathon because Kern County in the Kern River Valley was hit with a pretty devastating wildfire that recently got rejected for federal assistance. And there are a lot of things that technology can do to help. And one of the programmers in our local community that's a member of MeSH approached us because he lives in Kern River Valley and his house could have gotten burned down. Many of his neighbors did. And we wanted to help. And what we all thought of was a hackathon, a way for people and the community to come together to see what technology can do, but also to do something meaningful. Technology usually, I mean, has at least in Bakersfield and the Central Valley, technology, it doesn't do useful things. But this is a very useful thing that technology can do, and it can help. And I think in Kern County, a lot of focus is on Bakersfield, but the really splashy things in technology that are happening are in the Mojave Desert side of Kern County. And that's not really well integrated into the Bakersfield and the valley side of Kern County. And we want more reasons to bring all those things together. And I think it's a California-wide issue, too, that we're touching on that can really make the rest of the state look at the Central Valley, at other places as sources for good technology ideas.
Irma, you started your first hackathon now 8 years ago with 59 Days of Code. Looking back at that now, if you could go back to your present self to yourself 8 years ago, what would you tell yourself about doing it? Maybe differently or this advice of what you learned. Now you've opened up a 50,000 square foot facility. You have, I don't know how many,
107
companies in your facility there and a lot of freelancers as well. What would you tell yourself?
Delegate better, among other things. So, I mean, you're in the middle of it and people are telling you, why are you spending your time on that? And you do it anyway, right? The folks sitting at this table and the folks in that building that you just described, they're doing it anyway. And so that advice I don't think needs to be given. But what we're failing to do almost across the board, not everywhere, but in this sort of startup ecosystem is finding new captains to carry the torch. That's what I would have told myself at that moment is to go find that next captain to carry that on, make it bigger, do a better job than you can do so that I can turn my attention to other things. But that's true for, I think, every entrepreneur. That's a lesson that we need to learn earlier is to say, you know, here's my thing, but now go make it yours.
Is it difficult to develop those captains?
Difficult, mostly because you're not paying attention, right? Because you're so in the middle of doing and executing and trying to make this thing big and splashy and all of these other things that you're not thinking to yourself, who am I going to get to take this over so that I can move on? And that's what we should be thinking about.
as we're talking about technology here in the Valley. We have guests with us. That was just the voice you just heard was Irma Ogwin from Bitwise, a local technology company, an incubator with a new 50,000 square foot facility in a century old building in downtown Fresno. Scott Burton runs Mesh in Bakersfield, located on the second floor above Dagny's Coffee, and Alyssa Harley is with Kit Community, a collection of local professionals who are in the tech community in Kern County. Scott, where do you see Mesh and the community going in the next, I don't know, 3 to 5 years?
Well, I'm just going to follow suit with Bitwise. they've actually done a really good job, and Fresno and Bakersfield are not much different. I mean, the industries are a lot alike. We would like to obviously open a larger facility and offer private office space because, I mean, as time goes on, we hope to see more companies coming out of Mesh or starting in Mesh, and we would like to do whatever it takes to keep that collaboration happening. They have 100-some companies, and we're far from that at this point, but we're also really new. So I think working towards that goal and trying to find some of those missing pieces for the ecosystem to come in and be more of an incubator for companies and help grow that. Because, I mean, things are like seeds. You water them, you take care of them, you do the right things, and you have all the right soil and whatnot. It'll grow into something great, and that's what we're going to try to do.
And, Alyssa, where do you see Kit going in the next 3 to 5 years as things grow? How would you like to see this evolve?
Well, I think with Kit, we would like to achieve nonprofit status now as soon as possible because of a lot more attention and opportunity now. But I think in 3 to 5 years, I'd like to have a program set up that helps new entrepreneurs set up their startups and have it more like an incubator that provides a lot more supportive services than, an organization that can help with whatever they need but doesn't have a structured program in place.
Irma, you've had good success working with local educational institutions. Fresno State has a facility that they rent inside your campus as their downtown center, others educational institutions as well. Overall, do you all think that there's enough integration between whether it's a CSUB or BC or Fresno State or Fresno Unified? What can be done to maybe make those connections? How is that process working? What do you think, Scott?
I think it's lacking where we're at. I mean, we've talked to some people and we've, had some discussions on things, but nothing's been solidified. So I think there needs to be a lot more outreach there. And it's tough for us because, I'm a software developer and I work full time, and so does the co-founder. So our time that we can dedicate to those kind of relationships is limited. But I think someone like with Kit Community, with Alyssa here, she can talk to those people and get those relationships established. So that's something I think would be better suited for her.
Yeah. What do you think about where the potential is for connecting the traditional educational institution with the non-traditional, something like what Bitwise does with the Geekwise Academy?
Yeah. Well, I think what's important with any incubator or open space for innovation to happen is to have those more traditional sets of institutions present with the very new, agile, and quick-moving startups, because you get experience that those startups learn from the established institutions, and you also get those established institutions learning how to be more innovative and keeping an eye on where technology is going and where new ideas can come from. And you also have an opportunity for students to get a lot more involved. I think when there are more established connections between the university and the startup ecosystem, then the students are less afraid. They tend to be very conscious about what their abilities are and can be afraid to take part in a hackathon. So if there's more established connections, that friction is lessened. And I am working right now with both professors from BC and from CSUB to get more integration there and to maybe have a joint hackathon, like with the CSUB Fab Lab and with Kit Community and Mesh and some of the other tech community partners. But I've constantly been looking for ways to integrate more pieces of the community together. So I think Kern County is very large and there's a lot of silos.
Irma, we just have a few minutes left. I want to turn that 3 to 5 year question to you. A few months ago, you and your co-founder, Jake Soberall, issued this open letter titled "The Universe is Asking a Question," and he went on to talk about the rationale for what Bitwise is right now and where you want to go. You said in that letter that in the next 5 years, and I quote, "We will build a 2.5 million square foot campus that will be home to over 1,000 technology companies and 250,000 new tech jobs in Fresno." That's more tech jobs than Google's worldwide employment, Apple and Facebook combined.
We have
in 5 years in Fresno. Sure. How do you do that? What was the reaction to the letter?
Overwhelmingly positive. So I think that in a city like Fresno, and especially of a certain age group, there are folks who are looking for that beacon of hope. They want the city to be that. They want the city to change into this thing that they're proud of, where they are satisfied and feel successful. That's what we're aiming to do, right? So the numbers are intriguing, and I do think that they're within our reach. There's a lot of work to do between now and then. But the important part is, and this is what we formed Bitwise to do, is to change the way that people feel about living in Fresno. We think technology is the tool to do that. We can attract quite a lot of people and jobs, companies, buildings, all of these different talent resources. But the important part is to change the way that people feel. And we think in order to do that, a campus is in order.
And in order to do that, you're going to build a light rail line that connects the rural communities, Biola and Firebaugh, to Fresno. Are the tech workers going to live in those communities? Because that's not what we see in other tech communities. It seems like the tech workers want to live in more of an urban setting.
I hear the smile in your voice, by the way, when you say this. So the reason that the tech workers, so we've studied a bunch of other cities, of course, when, before and after, of course, we wrote the letter. And a lot of the reason that the tech workers don't live inside the city, or the reason that they live inside the city, rather, is because they don't have options. And so they can't live in these bedroom communities. It takes too long to get to the city center and so on and so on. But what we're intending to do is build that infrastructure so that if they want to live in Biola or Carruthers or what have you, that's an option. But more importantly, it gives access to the people out there in those rural communities that don't currently have access to these new and different ways of being educated, getting access to this industry.
And we've talked about the access or the challenge of getting capital, because that's sort of what makes so much of this work. Is that the best use of that capital to build a rail line from Biola to Fresno or Firebaugh to Kingsburg? I mean, we're talking at Austin's building a light rail system right now. It's $100 million a mile, 60 miles from Riverdale to Biola. So in the overall picture, maybe I'm just not clear of how the train fits into your vision.
Yeah, it's a really long-term play, right? So you're not going to see the immediate effects on day one, the second the shovel hits the ground kind of a thing. But go and talk to the folks in Las Vegas. Go talk to the folks in Austin. Go talk to the folks in San Jose. And if you ask those folks what they would have done differently before their communities exploded with technology, they say unequivocally, we would have built a train. And so we don't want to make that mistake. It's going to be a really long-term play, but we're going to see everything you know about the Valley changing, its makeup, its fabric, the way that people move, how many cars are on the street, all of those types of things. We say all the time, education, in particular here, technology education, is the single most important thing that we do. Second to that only can be access to that education. And so this will change that.
Certainly, the results are there with the workforce you have at the current facility and the students who are learning at the Geekwise Academy. We've been talking about the local technology ecosystem in both Fresno and Kern counties today. Irma Olguin, who you just heard from, co-founder of Bitwise, and also we'd like to thank Scott Burton with Mesh, a co-working space in downtown Bakersfield, and Alyssa Harley with Kern Innovation Technology, a local group of technology enthusiasts and professionals. Thank you all so much for joining us today, and best of luck as the Valley's tech industry continues to blossom.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's all for this segment. Stay with us. We'll be back and learn about why the effort to save the salmon has another fish species in the crosshairs. We'll learn what lawmakers want to do to reduce the bass population in the Delta and why it's a problem. That's up next on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. The effort to preserve a healthy population of salmon in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta is a huge challenge. Those little fish have a lot of factors working against them. As FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, a bill in the House of Representatives is trying to take on one of them, the striped bass.
The Save Our Salmon Act by Republican Jeff Denham of Turlock would update a 1992 environmental law that manages fish in the Delta. That law sought to increase the number of salmon, but it also set out to double the number of striped bass. The result? Lots of striped bass in the river system, which Denham says are bad news for baby salmon.
This non-native fish is eating all of the fish that we're trying to save. This is a great way for Republicans and Democrats to come together to address an issue of water and of saving our salmon.
Denham's bill would allow people to catch more bass with the hope that salmon would benefit.
We are opening up the striped bass to allow for greater removal, allowing fishermen to fish higher limits, which will actually give our salmon a fighting chance to survive.
The bill successfully passed through the House in early July. Democratic Congressman Jim Costa of Fresno says the bill received bipartisan support. Costa says the drought helped give lawmakers a better understanding of the issue.
More and more people have begun to learn the science, the biology of the multiple factors that are causing the decline of fisheries that are native to California.
Costa says the bill is imperative to keep salmon alive, but also to preserve water for farmers looking at tiny allocations this year.
We also hope that as a result of this, we can not only help the salmon, but gain greater water supply reliability, which the San Joaquin Valley has been devastated by.
Striped bass aren't native to California, but even still, 24 years ago, the authors of the Central Valley Project Improvement Act set the goal to double their population. Advocates like Aubrey Betancourt, the executive director of the California Water Alliance, applaud the Save Our Salmon Act.
Implementing a predator management program like the Save Our Salmon program is a practical step to addressing one of the many stressors in the Delta.
Betancourt says by decreasing the amount of bass, farmers could in the long run have more access to water.
The health of the salmon and the smelt is a critical factor in determining the operation of our water supply. And so there's a domino effect to how each of those elements relates to each other.
Denham's bill quotes a 2013 study along the Tuolumne River near Don Pedro Dam east of Modesto, saying that 93% of juvenile salmon smolts ended up as dinner for striped bass. But not everyone is so sure that efforts to decrease the bass population will actually save salmon.
They are not a cause of any of the declines. They're just a symptom of the general decline of the system, because striped bass are actually decreasing anyway because their habitats have been declining in quality.
That's noted UC Davis biologist Peter Moyle, who studies fish, like the threatened Delta smelt. He says the larger issue for salmon isn't bass, but humans.
We're a predator not only by the direct harvest of fish, but also by the fact that all our stream diversions and various other things we do to the water also harvest fish.
He says hatchery-released salmon are especially vulnerable since they're raised in giant tubs and fed by humans. When released, they can die of exhaustion and are often eaten by scavengers like the white catfish because they lack the skills to avoid predators. Moyle says the best way to preserve the salmon population is to improve the ability of the ecosystem to support them, because the early life stages set population size.
It's much easier to blame the predators for fish declines rather than the fact that whole ecosystems have changed because there's insufficient water to make them work right.
He says if the bill becomes law, it should be instituted as an experiment with clear objectives to determine its success. But for it to get there, a companion bill will have to go through the Senate, where a larger conversation about water legislation in California is taking place. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Tulare County community of Lindsay is known for many things, from olives to citrus to notable residents and war heroes. But surprisingly, little has been written when it comes to the city's history. That glaring problem has been at least partially addressed by a new book. It's called simply Lindsay, and it's by author Sarah Troop, who is also the curator of the Lindsay Museum and Gallery. Troop is giving a talk at the Lindsay branch of the Tulare County Public Library Thursday night from 6 to 8 p.m. She joins us now on Valley Edition to talk about some of the city's hidden gems in history. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
Your new book is about the history of Lindsay, stories and images of one of Tulare County's gems. You talk about a lot of the early days of this Tulare County community, and you use this phrase, the second gold rush. What sort of gold are we talking about in this second rush?
Well, interestingly enough, the second gold rush was oranges. And that's really, Lindsay is known for its olives, but the town is really built on oranges. This citrus gold rush is really where kind of a lot of the California towns, particularly in Southern California, really made their money and built up this whole citrus industry. And that's really what Lindsay was built on. There were something like 16 massive packing houses there. There were so many people that they needed to keep these things running that kind of if you came to Lindsay, you knew you would be able to find work or a job, whether it was in the fields or one of these many, many packing houses.
Why was it citrus in Lindsay? Was there something in particular about the area that made it good to grow oranges, or was this the accident of history?
Kind of both. It was actually part of a business plan that was contrived by an old United Kingdom Army captain named Captain Hutchinson. And Hutchinson married a member of the Patton family. And they moved to Southern California and were looking kind of to get into making business deals. And real estate was very big at the time. So they kind of went up and down California and found this little area, which became Lindsay, and thought that they would kind of buy up so many acres of this land and they would parcel it off, but they needed to kind of come up with a selling point for it. So what they did is Mrs. Hutchinson ended up trying to plant citrus trees to see if they could sell them that way. Then they would sink the wells, prove to people that they could grow citrus there, let them know that the citrus grew very well, and that this is the day how other people could come and make their own money. And so that's exactly what they did. They were able to grow these trees, and they flourished here. And we were able to grow them, grow lemons and oranges, long past any other place in the United States. So we were sending out shipments of citrus still just before Thanksgiving, which at the time was kind of unheard of. And when people around the U.S. were hearing about this, then they became interested and started coming out here and were able to really make a grand profit on it.
Now, Lindsay is still known today for its citrus, maybe a little less so since the big freeze back in the early 1990s. But where did the other big crop come into the picture? And that's olives. How did olives become synonymous with Lindsay?
There were olive trees were kind of in this area. No one's really quite sure how they came over, but they believe that Franciscan missionaries planted the first olive trees in the area. And in a different part of California, more northern part of California, there was a woman named Mrs. Emmon. And Mrs. Emmon suddenly became a widow unexpectedly. And she had no income. She had children that she needed to take care of. And she was determined to make some kind of income for herself so she could make a living and keep her kids fed and keep her property and her home. Now, the only resources that she had was olives grew on her property. So she contrived this way of preserving olives and corresponded back and forth with a professor at Stanford University in chemistry about different processes that she could use to preserve the olives. And once she had perfected that and started selling her olives and canning them successfully, our olive farmers in Lindsay actually began to adapt her recipe and were able to make kind of an industry here for that as well, because they were really having to ship olive products, oil, things like that, from Italy, which was incredibly costly, especially out to the West Coast. So that, again, became a very lucrative business here.
Now, your book called Lindsay not only documents the industrial productivity of this Tulare County community, but also the people, and specifically the veterans who called Lindsay home and went off to fight in America's wars. You write about a number of them, but specifically Merchant Marine Cadet Edwin O'Hara and the members of the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team, still the most decorated unit in U.S. military history. Tell me how that came to be, especially for someone with the Merchant Marine.
O'Hara had just come out of high school, and it was just sheer kind of bravery and misfortune that he was helping to transport supplies. And unfortunately, they came under fire, and the other servicemen on the ship at the time were injured and hit. And O'Hara really had to step forward and take control of the situation and ended up shooting the other ship down. And he's really regarded as one of the great naval heroes of our time at a very, you know, very young age, coming from Lindsay. And then as for the 442nd, a lot of people don't realize that a large percentage of Lindsay's original population at the turn of the century was made up of people of Japanese ancestry, so much so that there was a Japantown in Lindsay. There was a school and hotels and restaurants and stores that were all catering to Japanese Americans. And then, of course, when Pearl Harbor was bombed and we made the terrible action of forcibly removing all persons of Japanese ancestry and placing them in concentration camps for the duration of the war, many of those that were removed volunteered to be in our American military, and they enlisted. And of course, our military was segregated at the time, and so they were put into Japanese units. And there are many, many stories out there of the heroic deeds and things that they accomplished. There are a lot of military historians that still say to this day that if it wasn't for the Japanese American members of our military during World War II, that the war would have lasted at least another 2 to 3 years.
So, Sarah, how did you go about collecting all of these really interesting stories and far more that are in your book, and some great historical imagery from the original glass plate negatives? How did you go about putting this together?
Well, it was kind of difficult because there hasn't been much written about Lindsay. And much of what is often recounted as history is often false or inaccurate, because we as people, we love a good story. And so often history kind of falls victim to the good story in lieu of facts. And it kind of ends up being like that childhood game of telephone, where the story keeps getting more and more distorted or embellished as it goes on. So I kind of had to extract memories from history, and history kind of being a reconstruction of the past, but totally rooted in research. And unfortunately, in this day and age, a lot of our photographs, our history, has been put up on eBay, or we find it in thrift stores, because the museum that I work for that sponsored the book has only been in existence for a couple of years. We didn't have that much to use or to go on. So we put out calls to the community, to the public, to please bring in their photographs and their family history. But I also found a treasure trove of things digging around at other cultural institutions, special collections, and universities, and the most valuable ones that I found were located at Fresno State in their special collections room.
Before we go and remind our listeners about the event that's happening Thursday night at the Lindsay branch of the Tulare County Public Library, I have to ask, how did Lindsay get its name?
Lindsay was actually named after, I mentioned her before, the founder and his wife, Captain Hutchinson, named the town after his wife's family's name. So her name, she was Sarah Lindsay Patton Hutchinson. And because her family, there were no males in the family to carry the Lindsay name forward, he named the town in honor of his wife's family.
It's a great story. What's happening Thursday night? You're giving a presentation, and I assume there will be copies of the book available at that time. Tell us about what's happening this week.
So I'm going to be talking more about how I created the book, what the different challenges were, and kind of how I really extracted some of the stories that were out there from history. And how, as a historian, kind of the ways that we prove that facts or historical facts or things that we include in books are real. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what my journey as a historian is, and talk more about the sources of the photographs, how the book was made, and share some of the stories that didn't make it into the book, and elaborate more on some of the more incredible stories that did.
The community of Lindsay is the subject of this new book by author and Lindsay Museum and Gallery curator Sarah Troop. She'll present a visual history from her new book, Lindsay, at the Tulare County Lindsay Branch Library on Thursday night from 6 to 8 p.m. That's located at 157 North Mirage Street in Lindsay. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we want to know what you think. Email us. We are talk@kvpr.org, and we are on Twitter @KVPR. You can find us also @Valley Edition and on Facebook. Just type in Valley Public Radio, and we're there. Be sure to follow our page for updates throughout the week, local news and reporting up and down the San Joaquin Valley. You can find audio archives and our podcast online as well. Just visit kvpr.org on your computer or mobile device. You can also send us an email there as well. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Kerry Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.